Welcome to the Principal Liner Notes Podcast. This is Sean Gaylord coming to you with another return, if you will. It doesn't happen too often that I have a returning guest, and I am very grateful to have back on the podcast Megan Lawson. Megan, welcome back.
It is such a treat to be back. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm still reflecting upon and enjoying and savoring our last conversation.
Same here as well. And I know that since that conversation on the your last visit, which I guess was a couple of weeks ago, it really is great when we take the time in our respective gigs to sit down and think and reflect and share with another thought partner, whether it's through a podcast, whether it's, you know, after a faculty meeting or after a departmental meeting or district meeting. And this is like, I kind of imagine what this conversation, you know, we're in a district meeting. And then everybody walks to the parking lot, right? And then there's the either the meeting or conversation afterwards, and you find kinship, or you find empathy, or you find understanding, and that's kind of what this is, right?
I'm smiling at that metaphor because I often say that you know a meeting or a learning session was a good one when people aren't running to escape the room, right? They linger, they want to talk more. And that is exactly how our last conversation felt. So here we are wanting to linger and talk more.
Absolutely. So thank you for that. Linger and talk more. And I know kind of our purpose for this follow-up conversation is the rabbit hole that we went down last conversation on the television series, The Bear. And after the podcast that you were on, you then wrote a blog post, which kind of took on The Bear. And if you could, for those that haven't, don't follow your blog, and they should, they do follow your blog and they haven't had an opportunity to read that masterful post, maybe just kind of encapsulate a little bit of what you wrote.
Oh, sure. Thank you for mentioning it. So in the show, The Bear, there's a character named Marcus who is pursuing, you know, he's a chef, but he's pursuing pastry chef. And he goes to Copenhagen to study under, a guy named Luca, another chef. And there's this scene where the two of them are working side by side. And I talk about that in my blog. I love that as a nice metaphor for our work, being shoulder to shoulder in the work. And as they're working with this dough, Marcus is very curious about what made Luca so successful. And I found this conversation so thought-provoking because, sure, Luca talks about all kinds of things, you know, being in a very highly competitive environment and working with somebody who he always thought was a couple steps ahead of him, always better than him, and how that pushed him to work harder. But then he goes on to say that he believes that some of the best work that he has seen is not from someone's masterful skill or, you know, from even their discipline or their hard work. Though all of that is quite important, he goes on to say that some of the best things are good because they were inspired. And he goes on to say, you know, that if you can spend all of the time in the world in here, and if you're thinking about it from the school perspective, we can spend all of the time in the world in school and working on school stuff. But if you don't spend enough time out there experiencing the world outside of your profession, you know, and then he just sort of lets that linger, but we're to assume that we're not going to be able to get to the level of inspired, impactful work that we desire. And I just thought That's incredibly thought-provoking for us as educators as we all work to make a really inspired and meaningful impact on students.
Yeah, that episode, and here's another disclaimer that I probably should have said at the very beginning. We were talking about this pre-show is for those of you who have not seen The Bear and you do not wish to learn any more about the outcome of season one and season two. This is not a spoiler-free episode of the podcast, so we are going to share as we've both seen both seasons. So, you know, press pause or press stop and go do something else, or read Megan's blog post or her other blogs as well. But you can read Megan's blog at meganlawson.com, and it's Megan with an H. So I just want to say, for, cause we're going to talk very freely and openly about the Bear. So, this would be a good place to stop. So I'm going to do a pregnant pause. Okay. Now we can talk about The Bear. All right. So welcome back to the Principal Light Arrows podcast. Okay. So Megan, for and that Copenhagen one, from a technical standpoint, that episode, like the entire series, is filmed so beautifully. It makes me want to jump on a plane and just move to Copenhagen and live on a houseboat and feed an invisible cat named Coco. where do you see that with educators, that connection for us to learn outside? And I know I riffed on that a little bit a couple of episodes ago, but I was just kind of curious from your standpoint, where do you see that learning outside of yourself or outside of your realm? How does that resonate for you?
I appreciate you asking that. And then I want you to maybe share for yourself, because I'm intrigued by what you might say.
Sure.
I think in my case, I'll just use books as an example. I love to read. And I think there was a period of time in my career at the time I was a classroom teacher where most of the books I was reading were technical, like science of education books, which are certainly very important. You know, we want to ensure that we're using high yield strategies grounded in research. But I think what I'm learning as I progress through our profession, as more years pass, I'm learning how important it is to read books that aren't specific to our profession, that aren't specific to the world of work, period. I think the more we allow ourselves to be exposed to ideas or creative thinking that we can use to make connections to our work, the more inspired or creative or inventive our work can become. As an example, and there's actually a reference to this text in season two of The Bear,
yes,
but Unreasonable Hospitality by Will Gadara is one of the best books that I would say I've read in the last year. I believe it came out about this time last year. And for those who may not know, Will Gadara turned 11 Madison Park into the number one restaurant in the world. Like, it was in the top, 50. And he talks about how he did it. And the subtitle of Unreasonable Hospitality is The Remarkable Power of Giving People More Than They Expect. Mm-hmm. And in his book, it's very much so about the customer experience. And we can get into in a little bit how this book is connected to season two of The Bear. But in the meantime, I would say an example for me of making a connection to education, I think a miss on our part as educators is often we forget that we too have customers, the students that we serve in classrooms, the parents in our community, the communities themselves. And I think if we find more opportunities to elevate people's experience and give them more than they expect, I think, learning goes up, learning becomes more interesting and fun, and people start to want to do more than we originally expected of them as well, because they're, excited about the experience they're receiving every day. So I think that's just one example, in my case, where stepping outside of even education books has given me perspective about what it looks like to do the work in school.
Yeah, I would say to that for me, the Simon Sinek TED Talk, and then later the book that evolved from it, Start With Why, was my first entry into learning things outside of the world of education. And that was both a life-changing and career-changing moment for me when I first saw that TED Talk. I do need to track down Unreasonable Hospitality, as you mentioned. So I do see a run to the bookstore probably after this podcast that we recorded. But it also got me thinking too in season two of Stacy reading Leading with Heart, the Coach K book. Right? And how here she is finding inspiration from college basketball to help as they're creating the restaurant that is now known as Bear in season two. And then, as to also answer your question. So thank you for throwing it my way. I, definitely reading books outside of the realm I really enjoy doing. And I also enjoy asking what people are reading. So sometimes that conversation too leads me to different things. But then I would also say too, for me, a lot of it is music and film, and drawing meanings from, either the history of a band or, maybe it's an inspirational film, or there's a scene in a film, that I'll come across, very much. And I learned a little bit of this from my dad. My dad is a big time movie buff. And I remember he recommended the classic, World War II film, 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. And he had said that film was taught or used as an example for business executives in terms of kind of wrapping their heads around change leadership. And I always found that fascinating, film and scenes and things like that. And then I would say the other thing too, and I know you do this as well, is maybe it's not necessarily an educator thing, but I know a lot of educators do this, but exercise. Sometimes I'll get my best ideas from a workout. Now I am no Olympian or marathon kind of person. I'm not one of those guys, but I do find that sometimes the art, or the act rather, of doing something that's not in the grind of the day, I get a lot of inspiration from outside. Again, very similar to Marcus and Stacy, and really that whole sequence of learning that's going on in season two, with the different characters that where Carmi is pushing them elsewhere to either learn directly in their discipline or in some ways outside, as Stacy is reading that book Leading with Heart by Coach K.
You're making me think of Tina a little bit.
Yes,
she's easily one of my most favorite characters because she reminds me of some really important lessons that I've learned. She starts the season being very opposed to doing things differently, listening to feedback from Sydney, and then you see that she, you know, tastes something that Sydney made, and she humbles herself to realize, like, okay, wow, that's actually really good. I'm a little, and then she, you see her add extra seasoning that Sydney had added the next time she personally makes it, and then you see Sydney give her positive feedback about her dish and the way that she, it's childlike, the way that she lights up. And I think it softens you toward her and you realize, okay, you know, she's just somebody who needs someone to pour into them,
yes,
and help her, you know, realize the assets that she's bringing to this kitchen and the talent that she brings and that she can learn new things. And that, and I just think she's such an important reminder. It's very easy to give up on people or just decide people are just one way and that they're always going to be stuck in their way. And sometimes I think the people who need love the most are the ones who ask for it in unlovable ways, for lack of a better description. And so for me, that's just a great reminder, whether it's students in our classroom or the adults that we work with who tend to be negative, you know, they seem a little negative or rough around the edges, or, you know, always anti to the change, you know, or what have you, that, you know, we can learn a lot from those individuals. And but also, you know, they have more potential than you may realize in the initial moment.
Beautifully said, Megan, because the character of Tina in season one and all of the characters in some way go on a journey and go through some level of transformation, or in other cases, they're in the middle of a transformation and it's not necessarily resolved, based upon the events of season two, the way that it kind, there's this abrupt ending. But Tina is someone that, you know, when I saw it, first saw her character, I didn't like her. I found her to be a bully. I found her to be mean-spirited. There's a couple of moments where she does some things intentionally to sabotage the character of Stacy. Now, some of that is restaurant kitchen politics. And unfortunately that does happen. I say that as somebody used to wait tables and bus tables as a kid. But by the time you when you just see how she is, and to use your word, literally savoring the things that are happening in the kitchen, she savors the family that is built in that unit. And then you see how she is just soaking up, and she's so open to learning and growing and going to culinary school, and that moment when Carmi gives her his, you know, one of his special knives.
Mm-hmm.
It is a reminder, you know, because, you know, we tend to villainize and the negative voices and the naysayers that are in our profession. It's very easy to do so, right? But here in the Bear, I don't think there are, and it's very similar to Ted Lasso. You may think someone's a villain, but there's a reason why they may be cast that way, or why they cast themselves that way. And when Tina says at several times throughout, when she becomes vulnerable, and she'll tell Carmi or she'll tell Richie, I loved Michael, I loved Mikey, I loved him too. You know what he meant to me. You know, almost, and she's this a maternal figure, you know, very much a mother figure in the show. So it's a very powerful lesson learned for those of us that, you know, crusade against the status quo, and we villainize and demonize, you know, these folks that, you know, stand in, you know, that stereotypically stand in the way of change, right? But there's more to them. They have value, I believe. And what's at the root of their hesitancy? What's at the root of their negativity? And maybe if we get to the root of that, we may find something and discover something that, you know, adds up to more than what we think.
I love those examples you gave about Tina. And I think you see that she's afraid. You know, she's afraid to not be successful, afraid of what her place is going to be now that Michael is gone. And I do think a lot of the behavior sometimes that we see, adult behavior, student behavior, that I think taking a closer look at whether or not there's fear in place, fear of the unknown, fear of, can I do this? What's it going to take to do this? Is at play. And I loved what you said about the other characters as well, because I was telling my husband Mario this about the show as I was reflecting. What's very unique about this show is that they show the deeply human and sometimes ugly side of these characters, and you still find yourself loving all of them and rooting for them. And it's unique in that usually when you watch, or even if you read a fiction book, in the plot, you know, there's a villain, there's, you know, protagonist, antagonist. In this show, I think the antagonist is people's own personal battles. I can't think of one specific person that is against these people. And I think it's just really a beautiful reminder. They're so flawed and imperfect, and you still love them and see the good in them. And it's a really important reminder for all of us that that can be true for us and the people in our lives too.
Absolutely. That I think you just wrote a blog post there. I really do. That's a rewindable moment, as I often say on the podcast. So when we press submit on this and it goes to publish, you need to go back to what you just said, because I think that's either your concluding sentence or your opening sentence. I don't know what it is, but there's something there, my friend.
Thank you for that. I definitely will. I'll think about that more.
One of the things too, in our texting back and forth and tweeting back and forth since our first conversation, is the and this really comes through in season two, is the concept of time. There's a lot of references, and I'm kind of rewatching the season two with my wife. We started watching season one, and then she started falling asleep, but I kept going, and and then I went, actually she stopped, she felt she kind of dropped off at episode four of season one. So then we restarted back, and now we're about halfway through season two. So I'm picking up on different things. And in season two, I'm picking up on the urgency of time. There's a lot of references to alarm clocks, timers, especially in the Christmas episode. We're going to go to down the path of the Christmas episode. We would be remiss if we didn't a little bit later, but every second counts. I would love to hear your take on that. There's it comes up quite a bit.
It does come up quite a bit. And I want to hear your thinking too. It feels really important. In my case, I think about, you know, I write about this in my book. My dad passed away from leukemia when he was 33 years old. And when I turned, the year I was turning 34 was a really strange year for me, because I didn't know how to be older than my dad. Like, what does that mean as far as like the, you know, here you always think about your parent being older than you. And here I couldn't quite fathom, what that was going to mean for how I was going to think about him. I know that it's kind of hard to describe, but I've heard others who've experienced it say that they've felt something similar. And I think the way that I found a path forward and found healing that year was through doing some work for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. But also, I think what I realized was I could pursue every day and every year that I got to live that he never got to experience as a 34-year-old, 35-year-old, now I'm 41, that I could pay tribute to him and his legacy by living fully for both of us. And there was something about thinking about it that way that gave me permission to enjoy. I use that word savor a lot, but there was something about thinking in that manner that was very healing. And so when I think about every second counts, I also want to never forget to be grateful for the simple gift of another day.
Thank you for sharing that. That's quite powerful, my friend. And I know the listeners that are tuning in to appreciate you sharing that personal memory, and we receive that as a gift. With every second counts, it really, to me, there's a few things there. One, in terms of the urgency of time and savoring the time that we have with those whom we love. And then I also see it too as someone that I'm a big picture person, and I often describe myself as staying at 40,000 feet. And often I don't take the time to look at a detail or two, and season two and it goes into so many different places where all of these small things matter to a larger whole, and that we have to pay attention to them and put some thought and heart into it. So I often don't see it as a time thing, but I see it as an intentional thing. Not necessarily every second counts, but second is a smaller version of time, or a smaller measure of time, right? And how you see all of these kind of small attentions to details, and they all matter. Whether it is in Copenhagen when they take the tweezers and Marcus is learning how to put the whatever that thing is on the pastry, right? Or even Richie, where he takes he learns the value of that, right? When he has his little apprenticeship in terms of the placing of forks and why those things matter. So often in our gig, right, we're very goal oriented, big goal oriented, right? And we've got to hit this mark. But there's a lot of small things that add up to that mark or that goal or whatever that may be that cannot be overlooked. Whether it is the conversation that we have on the way to a faculty meeting or another appointment, and that conversation may not be a big deal to those that are waiting for you to get to the meeting, but it is a big those 5 minutes that we take, or 30 seconds that we take to connect with a child, or to connect with a teacher, or to connect with a colleague to say, hey, how are you? Hey, did you watch the game last night? Hey, why are you wearing that today? Or wow, that's beautiful, or whatever it may be. Those things matter, and those things resonate, right?
I'm so glad you went there with that. And speaking of Richie and details, I'm reminded of, well, let me start by saying this. I said, that all the characters are lovable and they're flawed. I had the hardest time with Richie, and I didn't feel at the end of season one, I wouldn't have been able to say what I said about all of the characters, being flawed but lovable. I had a really hard time with Richie until season two. And we get a little deeper into, what makes Richie tick and where his struggles come from. And you mentioned that about detailed work. And he has that moment with Terry, the Michelin star restaurant owner, where he goes and has his apprenticeship, and the two of them are peeling mushrooms. And, he asks her, kind of like, why are we doing this? And she was saying, that this is a way that we let people know that a lot of time and care went into their dish. It's just a little detail that shows them that. And he goes on to say, though, why are you doing this, though? You have all these people that work here. Someone could do this. And she says that by doing it, it is respect. It feels attached. I think time spent doing this is well spent. And I think about how easy it is sometimes. Whether it's walking by a piece of trash on the ground and picking it up in the hallway of the school, or jumping into a classroom and helping out when you see that there's a need and you've got a couple minutes where you could do that. I think staying grounded and ensuring that there's no work that's below any of us is really important in respecting what it takes for every person to do the work and make this place work. And, I'm actually reminded of, I wrote this in someone's evaluation last year. I refer to them as someone who paints ladders. And the story comes from my husband actually works in college basketball, and they had won their conference. And you know how teams will go up the ladder and they'll take turns cutting a piece of the net off and holding it in the air, and they get to hold on to that piece of net. And the night before, he looked and saw that, indeed they had a ladder, but the ladder was yellow and their colors are navy and white. And he thought, okay, well, this is a monumental moment. There's going to be a lot of pictures taken. People are going to cherish these photos and this memory forever. This ladder needs to be blue. And he would never tell this story to other people. He's not braggadocious in that way, but he stayed really late and painted that ladder blue. And, I think if you were to look at his job description, painting ladders isn't listed. And yet, that small detail to make something really special and memorable for people, it matters. And I think those of us like you who take the time to have those hallway conversations, and you said something to me before we press record about how important it is to you that people feel like they're the only person in the room and that you appreciate when people do that for you. Those are the kind of people with the attention to detail and attention to others that make this life, this work really special and make us feel like, you know what, I've got some potential and capability here because this person cared and they see something in me. And at the end of that conversation, Richie and Terry have, she says he's really skeptical about why Carmi sent him there. I think he thinks deep down that he was just getting on his nerves and that he just needed to ship him off for a little bit, because the truth was Richie wasn't really contributing in a meaningful way. He was causing more problems for everybody, floundering, looking for his place of value. And, she says to him that something along the lines of, I think she says, he was right about you. And, right. And Richie says, well, what makes you say that? Or no, she says, he believes in you, That's what she says. He believes in you, And Richie says, what makes you say that? And she says, he told me. And he said, you're good with people. And then she affirms it, by saying he's right, And now here there are these two people that Richie looks up to who have that to say about him. And from that moment on, Richie is showing up differently back home in that restaurant. And I just think that's such a powerful reminder for all of us. Like you said, every second counts, and you gave those great examples. That is the perfect example of no small moments right there.
Yeah. And that scene, I adore that actress that who plays Terry Olivia Coleman. And it's so natural. It's so real. That scene is, I mean, there's a lot of real in the bear, but that scene is so real without it getting in your face, right? And the actor who plays Richie, Eben Moss Backrock, his transformation is the most powerful, because when we meet him in season one, he is this misogynistic, homophobic, cocaine dealing, I mean, he's a jerk, and he, you know, he bullies everyone in the restaurant. You know, he and Sydney have that really intense argument, and then she accidentally stabs him in the butt, and you know, or that, and he goes, "All right, I've been stabbed." You know, he turns around, and then by the time we get to the beginning, and he's fighting, right? He's fighting against all of the changes that Carmi is doing. He's fighting hard. He feels like he is the real heir to the beef, that he is the real heir to Mikey's vision of the restaurant. And then when we meet him at the beginning of season two, we see the beginning of this journey where he's quoting philosophy. He's quoting Siddhartha. You know, he's trying to find ways to improve himself. I think a lot of that is driven by him wanting to connect with his daughter. And, you know, he's overcoming, we learn that he's overcoming a broken heart, very bitter divorce, with, who I guess we later learn is the love of his life. But this, it's such a powerful transformation. And I remember, you had hinted at this, my sister, who had recommended the show to me, and said, "Just wait, just hold on to Richie's transformation. It's powerful, and it pays off in so many ways, right? You know, oh."
I loved what you mentioned, the detail about the forks, which comes up multiple times, including when he goes back and wants to set that standard for Carmi's restaurant. And I love the scene where, you know, he finally in that apprenticeship leans into the fact that he needs to humble himself in the smaller details like that of forks. And then, you know, the guy runs in because they need some help. And he's like, you know, basically like, "You're in, we need you out front." And Richie says, "No more forks." And he hands him the suit to put on, and he puts on that suit. And he says, quote, "Feels kind of like armor." And you realize for the first time, he understands what it feels like to respect yourself and carry yourself with respect. And from then on out, it's humorous, but also endearing that, you know, he always wears suits, and
yes,
he heads home and people are like, "Suits?" And he's very, he says, you know, "Yeah, I wear suits now. It makes me feel good about myself."
Yeah.
And I just love that. And it takes them a minute, but I think there's another lesson there. You know, whether it's Carmi's sister, because, you know, they very much so, she and Richie had such a strained relationship, or otherwise, they allow Richie to reinvent himself. Here's this person who's caused probably all kinds of trauma in all of their history. And, you know, he genuinely apologizes to Carmi's sister. And she accepts it, and then they accept him as a new evolved version of himself. And I think another reminder for me in all of that is that, you know, the best kind of friends or people in our lives are the ones that support us in changing and evolving.
Yeah.
They don't make us stay stuck one way that they remember us being in the past. But if it's a good change and evolution, they're rooting for us. And I think, wow, I want to continue to reflect on how I can be more that way for the people in my circle too.
And when that happens in the schoolhouse or department or district, when I love how the culture of the bear and there's this kind of, and I don't think it's written anywhere, but it's how they accept Richie, you know, as he goes through this transformation. And I think that has everything to do with culture. And you know, sometimes I get a little heartbroken when I've seen this from a leadership perspective or educator perspective, is that when you do see characters in the schoolhouse like Richie making efforts to change and improve, or Tina, you know, wanting to learn as much as she can about being the best chef, all of them. And Carmi has kind of fostered this culture where that's allowed. But I'm often heartbroken when I see the opposite, when you see folks that make a change or try to do something different and step outside their comfort zone and improve or whatever. And then there is this resistance or vocal, like, what are you doing? You know, and how could you? And then folks retreat. Here, I don't, you in the bear, you don't see that. But then that got me thinking about other times and other gigs where I've seen folks really make an effort to change. And maybe it's not the change I want them to make as a leader, but it's still a change. It's going in a forward direction or a different direction, or it's leading to growth and it's resonating. And then there is a little bit of peer pressure to not go that way or to hesitate because a person wants to feel like they belong or doesn't want to be an outlier or what have you. You know what I mean?
I do. You're actually making me think a little bit about Sydney's story too, because, you know, she had that failed catering business. And when she first comes to Carmi, he's a little surprised that, you know, she wants to work there. He feels, you know, like her training and experience is beyond what she would start out doing there. And then she has this conversation with her dad, and this is later, probably in season two. And, you know, she's talking to him about how she, you know, she really needs to find her thing. I need to find the thing. And he's like, well, you know, no matter what, if you need to keep living with me forever, you could live here. And it's such a sweet thing for him to say, but she seems irritated by it. And I didn't quite understand that. And I don't know if I fully do yet, but like by the end of season two, he goes and they have that, you know, friends and family night, and he experiences her dishes and he's blown away by not only her talent, but also the culture of that restaurant, like you beautifully explained, and, you know, how they treated him and knew that he just wanted a soda for his table. And he finds her throwing up in the back, you know, because the stress and just being so maxed out, he finds her in the back and he tells her, you know, this is the thing. And
yes,
you know, line. Like there's that moment between them, like, yep, this is the thing.
This is the
and
thing.
I think sometimes, you know, we don't fully understand exactly why someone might be seemingly over the top about something that really matters to them, or the standard that they have on something that feels extreme to us, and, you know, or whatever it is. I think, you know, sometimes everybody just needs a thing that is going to remind them, you know, I can do a good job. This makes me feel good about myself. What I'm doing matters every day. And maybe the thing that they've pursued isn't the thing that we personally connect with, but it doesn't mean that it's not important. And I thought that was something for me to take away, you know, from Sydney's story about her thing.
Yeah. Megan, for you, what's your thing? What's the thing? I'm curious.
I like that question. I think I hope to be somebody who leaves people believing more deeply in their capabilities. I think it's really important to me that no matter what conversation I'm in, what work I'm a part of, what meeting I'm in, that if I share space with people, they leave feeling lighter, not heavier. And they leave feeling more capable than they walked in. And I think it's also important to me that people feel connected and like they're not in this by themselves. That's my thing, I think.
That's a good thing to have. And I'm just thinking how fortunate folks are to be on the receiving end of that. So that's very cool. I think too that I'm also kind of ruminating on what we call this episode. And maybe it's the thing, lessons from the bear, you know?
What's your thing?
Thanks. I think for me, it's meaningful collaboration where everyone feels valued and everyone feels compelled together to do something differently and innovatively, you know. So, you know, Carmi, and I'm not a Michelin chef or what have you, and I don't espouse his, some of his lifestyle choices are pretty intense. You know, he's kind of stripped himself and cut himself all off for this art, right? But I always try to see things beyond what they are and see that things can be different or taken to a level that's going to help change the world or change the world for somebody. You know, that's at the core of what I try to do is I want to do my part to help make the world better for others and to feel connected to that world. And it's probably a lot of why I've really just been connected to the bear. I've really just felt this kinship, right? And that's been my thing because it's reflected my thing, if that makes any sense.
It makes a lot of sense. I think if more people led through others in the way that you described and nurtured true collaboration, not cooperation, not coordination, yeah, you know, but collaboration, I think the world would change if we relied on each other more in that way.
Absolutely. One of the things too in the bear that I appreciated and I also appreciated you sending this to me is the deliberate use of music. And there were so many things, little details musically that really resonated for me. And then when you sent me the Spotify playlist, which I believe is every song that's played, whether it was for a second in any part of the bear or maybe a longer version, but there was just some things there that just really just stood out to me. Whether it was the use of Elvis Costello's Beyond Belief in that Christmas scene during that, just that there's a really kind of frenetic scene and that song is used to great effect, or the ending of season one with the use of Radiohead's Letdown, and that last scene of still just gets me to hard tears when Mikey and Carmi exchange those glances in that memory when they, you know, when they find the money. Oh, just there's just so much there, but I value the use of music there, and we you know, this is the Principal Liner Notes podcast. A big part of this podcast is music, but I'd love to hear your take on the use of music in both seasons of The Bear.
I think what I loved about the music is that there's some, it transcends across decades, the representation of different artists and styles of music.
Yeah.
But even that scene with Richie that I talked about, him putting the suit on and going out front, the sort of, you almost felt like it was a scene from Rocky, the way that the music is playing, where it's like, ooh, it's game time. Like, he is definitely going to be jumping into a high pressure, intense situation. The way that they used music in that scene to elevate your ability to climb into that feeling and feel the intensity behind it. I just think it reminded me of a lot of things, but one thing I think I texted you about is the way that music can help you tap into things that you might struggle to verbalize, or things that are under the surface that you didn't realize that you felt, or how memory takes you back, or music takes you back to a memory or a time that you hadn't thought about in quite some time. And it might even take you a while to think, like, okay, this is how I'm feeling right now as I listen to this music in the opening scene. Where do I think this is coming from? And then you're like, oh, that's, from a time in my life where that was a really hard time for me. No, that's why I'm feeling a little sad hearing it. I mean, it's amazing that I think music allows you to realize that there are things that your heart and spirit remember, or that are important to you, that you have pushed down, or that you've been so like caught up in the cerebral side of your work or your daily life. And, like, you need to kind of tap back into the heart and soul of the work. And that's what I think music does so well in the show. It makes me wonder, like, how it might contribute to our work and bringing that heart back to the work in our schools too.
Also, where do you see that happening in schools? I love that though.
Wait, I'm somebody who likes to play music when people walk into a meeting, and so,
Yeah.
and I'm also someone who feeds on other people's energy, and I think, if you want people to be excited about or energized by what's to come, music is a great way to create a feeling and an ambiance for people. And I've told some other people that I learned this from one of Alina Aguilar's books, that, treating meetings or learning sessions like it is a dinner party you're throwing for close friends can help people feel special and more connected. And something that you might find at a dinner party or a gathering is music. And so that's one example of how that looks in my work. Sometimes I'll shift gears in a meeting and we'll do a gallery walk, or we'll make connections between pieces of art and what we are aspiring to create, like in an ELA course of study, as an example, and changing, having music playing that you might hear in a museum or a gallery allows people to take on the spirit of, what you hope they'll bring out of that exercise with you, kind of calming the mind and slowing things down because we're in such a rush in schools. And so I know you and I talked about the rush of daily school life. I think music is also a tool I write about in my book that some people will use it as a teacher, though, whatever song they have playing. If secondary students, where there's all these class changes, like that next class is walking in with a specific song playing, the teacher could have certain songs that match certain classroom setups. So when they walk in and they hear a specific song playing, like, oh, this like super fun song is that reminder that we're, moving the desks into groups of three today. And so you're not only setting the tone for fun and collaboration, you're also signaling to them that it's time for them to help out and giving them a sense of ownership over what's about to happen. And they're feeling, valuable, like they're contributing to that community. So I don't know, those are just some things that come to mind for me. You are somebody who I love to hear talk about music with your passion and vast knowledge. I'm curious the kinds of things that you're thinking about.
Thank you. I want to go to one of your meetings. So and I would love, man, that would be fun to plan a playlist with you. And that actually, you and I have been talking about some collaborative opportunities for you and me. And that actually might be a very interesting entry point for us. And curating some music and the intentional use of music in spaces. That actually would be a fun project to do. We'll have to add that to our brainstorm session. But I really believe that music is that divine voice that connects us. And I've talked about it on the podcast. I've written about it. And it doesn't matter whether you are in Cincinnati or Winston-Salem. Everyone has some tie, I believe this, to music. Music is a part of our DNA. I often use music as an entry point for conversation. I did it as a teacher, where I would ask my students, what's on your turntable? What are you listening to? And even if I didn't know who the Smashing Pumpkins were, or Tupac was, and all of that, I would try to find some sort of connection. So and that might just be if I saw that saw that student, and I would say, hey, thank you know, are the pumpkins smashing? You know, and turn it into joke, or right, you know, or if I knew. If I was teaching a bit of literature, and I did this to great effect with The Great Gatsby, what would be, what kind of song would be written by, Biggie Smalls about the character of Tom Buchanan? What song would that be? Right. And often I don't use music in meetings enough. So I'd like to bring that back. But I might put a song in my weekly memo blog. But I often use it as an entry point. You know, what are you listening to? What's on your turntable? I still do that. If you go into my office, you'll see pictures of the Beatles. And usually someone will say, oh, I know them, or I have a favorite Beatles song, or what have you. So I'm very unabashed about my love for music, because I do believe, not just from the pleasure that I receive from it, and whether listening or playing or performing, but just it's that connection, because it's part of our DNA. It's what it is. It's who we are. But again, I love how you use that for meetings and space, and that I don't think we do that enough. So I'm going to take a page from your book.
Well, I'm going to take a page from your book too. There's something that you said about, I think the question that you said you asked was, what are you listening to right now? I really like that question. All of our meetings start with check-ins. I think that's a really fun check-in question.
Yeah.
It's also a fun spin on something that I ask people in a survey at the beginning of the year. The people I support, I ask them a series of questions. One of the questions I ask them is, what would be their walk-up song? What's the song that gets them jazzed to do and energized to do their very best work? And then I try to piece those songs together in a playlist, which, side note, I would love to build meeting playlists with you. So we definitely need to talk about that more. But I do wonder what it would look like to also build some playlists of just songs that, okay, it's not a walk-up song, but they're songs that people say they're listening to right now. And how do we use that to go deeper in a conversation, like you said, about, what anything that's on our mind, or what's going on with us right now, or why that song really resonates. So I appreciate you sharing that prompt. What are you listening to right now?
It's a lot of fun, and it creates conversation. And when you create conversation, you find kinship. When you find kinship, you find trust. When you find trust, you find belonging. When you find belonging, then that can lead to action, and dynamic action, and intentional action. I also appreciate your connection to Elena Aguilar and her analogy of the dinner party. There is an infamous dinner party in season two of The Bear, and that is the Fishes episode, and a Christmas dinner that will live in infamy. You had prepared me for it and just said, just watch out. My sister Courtney had prepared me for it and had said that episode is going to explain why people are the way they are. But in many ways, it does that. But in many ways, it also creates more questions for me. And there are characters that are introduced in that episode that are not referenced prior to and aren't referenced afterwards. But it is just chock full of just great cameos. Give the Emmy to Jamie Lee Curtis now, playing the mother of the Berzados, Donna. And, what's your take on that episode?
So well said about all aspects of characters and questions answered. And it was very artfully filmed too. I think you really feel like you're in the kitchen.
Yep.
You know, with all the timers and the chaos, and you empathize with Carmi, who just so badly wants to make everything okay and help his mom feel okay. My first reaction to that scene was, okay, you know, this is a nice reminder that crazy things happen in everybody's families, you know, like,
yeah,
they're sort of like, okay, not everybody's Christmas is perfect every year, and I'm no exception. But two, I think the scene where Michael comes under attack in that conflict that he has, I don't know if that's his stepfather or if, you know, who do you perceive that to be, that was really coming at him quite hard?
Yeah, Uncle Lee, played by Bob Odenkirk, and that's the thing too, is we're not 100% sure of everyone's relationship. So that's key. So like Richie and Carmi call themselves cousin very affectionately, but they're not cousins.
Right.
Cicero is referred to as uncle, but he's not an uncle. And then the Bob Odenkirk character, I don't know who he is. You don't know, is he a, you know, clearly he's a friend of the father's, but is he a stepdad? Is he a former stepdad? Is he, did he and Jamie Lee Curtis have a thing? Do they still have a thing? There's just a lot of unanswered questions, but yeah, Mikey and Lee have that standoff at dinner with the forks.
It was so incredibly uncomfortable. And I remember, yes, you know, like, first of all, it reminds me of plenty of moments, whether it's in my work or in my personal life, where I've wanted to be invisible because things are so uncomfortable and you can feel yourself like you would want to just hide under the table.
Yep.
I also felt so badly for everybody who just wanted to have a nice dinner, and, you know, what that feels like for probably a lot of people, not just at dinners, but in general, you know, you just really could use a nice moment. And, you know, whether in the classroom too, like, this, I would really just like for this to be a nice moment. And a couple of, you know, people are making that hard. And then there was part of me that was like, man, this guy deserves to get this fork from Michael. You know, I just felt for Michael, and he wasn't handling it well. And I know what that feels like too, to be the, you know, kind of feeling like you're just going to explode with the big feelings that you have. And then I think about, you know, Carmi and his mom and that really painful scene, you know, where she struggles to articulate what she needs or feels,
yeah,
and struggles, you know, to let him be there for her, in a way that would probably have been more healthy. And him sort of like as an adult child of hers grappling with, I'm an adult and I feel like I know what's best right now, but this is my mom, the authority figure, who's telling me something different, and what a conundrum to be in. And I imagine that many of us, sometime in our lifetime, whether we're currently experiencing it or will in the future, have been in some kind of situation that felt that way.
Yeah, it and even like the tight close-ups in that episode of people's faces, like you're it gets very claustrophobic. In and if we recall, the episode prior to that is this kind of slow ASMR Copenhagen and Marcus, you know, experiencing art, and it's a very light, airy, sublime episode. And then we go right to Sugar's, that tight close-up of the cigarette. Sugar's got the cigarette in her hand, and then you go to her face, and then Michael comes literally out of the frame into, and it's and then it ends with just this chaotic, apocalyptic car crash. Literally, it's a literal car crash where Jamie Lee Curtis's character rams the car into the house, and it's comedic and sad all at the same time, and disturbing. And what about the shot of Sugar's face when all that's happening? The turmoil, the epiphany, it's heavy. Whew.
I love what you said about the close-ups, because when I think about that scene, feeling really close to her face is the thing that I remember the most. And
yeah.
I think that was by design, where you know, she is such a tormented character, and you want so badly to make this a nice Christmas, and you feel like you're really there with her trying to figure this out.
And then when her character reappears so sadly in the final episode of season two, and it echoes what she, to your point, what she said, that kind of that last conversation she has with Carmi in the kitchen, where she says, all I want to do is make beautiful things. I want to make beauty. That's all I want this night to be. And no one appreciates it. And then I end up destroying it. And then she echoes that again in that, just probably one of the saddest scenes in the series, where she's outside the restaurant and Sugar's husband is encouraging her to come in. And she says, no, don't even tell them I was here. It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah, that scene was incredibly heartbreaking. You just wanted to get her. Well, part of me wanted to get her through the door, and then part of me thought, like, I wonder if she's right. You know, like, as sad as that is to say, like, not that they wouldn't want to see her, you know, but how would it go? And sort of that, I guess, where you're at that crossroads would be the word I would use. It was such a crossroads moment where you see both sides, and you want everyone to have her. And have their family intact in that restaurant. And then you think about, you know, how much struggle there is surrounding her and how much pain, and whether or not could it go okay. I mean, I get both sides of it.
Yeah, same here. There's so many layers in the bear on so many levels. I picked up on, even just being a fan of the Beach Boys, and the usage of kind of three songs from the Beach Boys oeuvre, you know, kind of paralleling when the band was kind of breaking away from surf music, and I see that, and that literally that same tension happened, you know, in the Beach Boys between Brian Wilson, who wanted to be more experimental and avant-garde and going away from the surf music. And that contrasted literally with his cousin in the band, Mike Love, who wanted to do more of the hits and surf music. And I saw that in the character of Carmi and Richie, you know, fighting for the soul and legacy of the restaurant. And here's that word legacy again, Megan, which I'd like to seg into for those who may not know. And we did make a you made a couple of references to your upcoming book, Legacy of Learning. But for those who may not be familiar with that you do have a great book coming. I'd love for you to share a little bit about the book. And just all of the love and soul and intentionality you put into it, because I adore that book and I can't wait for it to come out.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. There's the scene at the end of season two where Carmi gets stuck in the cooler,
yeah,
in the fridge, whatever the closet name is for that, you know, yeah, that space, and he can't get out. And how everybody steps up to make things work, and the realization that everyone is this ecosystem that's connected. And if we all do our part and figure it out together, incredible things happen, and we can do much more than we ever dreamed possible. That is what I hope is a takeaway from Legacy of Learning. I think people are overwhelmed. I know in any given day I am. I think it's a really hard time in education, and I hope that this book helps people find their way back to this work being both manageable and enjoyable. And I think I tried to write an honest book, you know, that talks about some of my struggles and the things that I continue to learn, lessons that I learn over and over again, and some practical strategies for just that, for making the work more manageable, having fun and getting excited to come every day, and in turn, doing the same for our colleagues and our students. And I hope that anybody reading it would leave feeling, like I said earlier, lighter and encouraged.
I definitely, having had the privilege of previewing the book, both those things, I felt, you know, feeling lighter and encouraged. So I know the book is due out sometime this month of October, and I can't wait for it to land on bookstores and bookshelves everywhere and Amazon. You mentioned the word ecosystem, which we would be remiss kind of not mentioning, because that's the word that Richie uses in the beginning of season one when he's fighting, you know, against the changes. Like, this is a delicate ecosystem. He talks about this is a delicate ecosystem, and but then you see that happening at the end of season two, where, you know, Carmi is locked in that cooler, and then Richie steps up to the expo, right? He's like, I got this. And you know, there's a disaster in the kitchen. They're behind. It's opening night for friends and family. And all of those, you see the ecosystem in action. Everything is kind of working towards that part. And the notion of delicate ecosystem, which arrives from Richie again at that point, this kind of roustabout cocaine dealing, you know, jerk. And then he's transformed and he's protecting the ecosystem. He helps sustain the ecosystem in this new version of the beef, which is now the bear. I couldn't let that go when you said ecosystem. I don't know if that was intentional or not, if you were making a nod to Richie or not.
I wasn't. I'm glad you reminded me that he said that. And I'm making connections between what you so artfully explained and our work in schools. You know, that it's amazing what happens when people feel like they're building something together and that their unique gifts and talents are contributing to the greater good. And that's something that I do focus on in the book because it's so important to me. And you talked about this whenever you were talking about your thing. What's your thing going to be? I think, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that is at the heart of what you're describing is what it looks like when you, you know, instead of focusing so much on deficit, which we tend to do in school, whether it's with students or staff. Not that we don't, you know, work on getting better, but where we spend just as much time, if not more, growing and nurturing the individual and collective brilliance of people so that we can use that, those assets to make an even better future, whether it's like using the talents that our kids have in our schools, you know, tapping into and utilizing the gifts that every single staff member brings. I just think it's too often overlooked. And I think one of the most beautiful legacies that we could have is to unearth, you know, the hidden gems of potential in other people and help them see that for themselves and nurture them on their path to, you know, succeeding in ways that they never dreamed possible.
That pretty much echoes the bear in many ways. I mean, and that's what each of the characters in some way, shape, or form, whether it is subtly, whether it is directly, whether it is done comedically in the character of Feck. we got to mention Feck, you know. you know, that they all do that in their own way for each other. And it's kind of tied to this building, upholding the legacy that Brother Mikey left. Right.
Perfectly said.
Oh, thank you, friend. You have many rewindable moments here, rewindable moments of perfection and insight. And I'm so just grateful for our kinship and our bonding over this little series that has kind of captured our attention called The Bear.
Thank you. This was chicken soup for my soul. So I appreciate the opportunity to make those connections between our work and the show. And I just always appreciate the opportunity to connect with you personally. I think you bring such heart and humanity to our profession, and I think we need it more than ever.
Well, thank you, Megan. I feel the same about you, and you always bring out the best and in such an intentional way. And like I said, I'm looking forward to the impending release of your book, Legacy of Learning. And friends, it is worth pre-ordering when it goes live. It's worth picking up. I know it will be the source of great faculty book talks and book clubs and insight, and it will be something that you'll revisit again and again. Be sure to also subscribe to Megan's blog at meganlawson.com. Megan is spelled with an H. And if you click on the link where it says about Megan, there's a beautiful graphic there. The real work is the work we do on ourselves. And this conversation is definitely, any conversation with you, Megan, is always work that is being done for the self. So thank you for that gift, friend.
Likewise, this has been time well spent, and I know I'm going to carry this conversation into my week and continue to think about how I can, I guess, really honor some of the things that we've talked about here, specifically giving people space to evolve and grow and not giving up on people or making assumptions about others. I mean, there's just so many things that I'm going to go back and make note of that I know can make me better in my daily work. So thank you for making the space for us today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for carving out space on your this is Saturday. And so this is a good bookend to the week. And we'll have to you know, maybe I know that I know that I'm gonna carry this conversation throughout the week, and I know that we'll text and communicate in some way. But I also think too, you know, perhaps for listeners, you know, whether it is through X or Instagram, maybe we need to do a little hashtag to keep the conversation going. And for those folks that have insights from either this conversation or from the bear, you know, maybe it's hashtag lessons from the bear. And we'll invite others to share their insights, as well. 'Cause I know you and I both appreciate connecting and finding kinship, with each other and others as well. So what do you think about that? I just came up with that.
Let's be sure to do that. I would love to hear what connections people are making to the show. There's endless connections that people can make, and I would love to open up the dialogue. So thank you. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do that. So hashtag lessons from the bear. We'll put that in the show notes. We'll put that out there when this podcast episode goes live, which will probably be at some point later in the course of the day, because I always like to get things out fast. So we'll do that. So for those of you that are listening and are intrigued or got an idea from watching the bear or listening to the conversation between Megan and me, drop us a post at hashtag lessons from the bear, and you can tag me in at SM Gaylord, and then Megan, you are what's your I know it, but I there's an underscore somewhere.
There is. Yep, it's at Megan MEGHAN underscore Lawson LAWSON.
Awesome Lawson. All right, there's some rhyme there. as we often end the podcast with, don't forgetting to share with the world your dreams and your visions and your ideas. So that goes without saying, but I also think too, we should end this particular, this special episode devoted to, the bear with an important line from the bear. And that is, every second counts, and you, the listener, you count and you matter. And you definitely add to all of those things that make great art, great ideas, and great things happening, just as Megan, you do the same.
Thank you, Chef.
This is the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is Sean Gaylord. I'm very grateful to have had Megan Lawson return for another episode of the Principal Liner Notes podcast. We look forward to continuing the conversation with the hashtag lessons from the bear. So please be sure to tag us in that, and we will circle back, and we'll just do the thank you, chef.